From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello and welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccant. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. And that makes this the stuff they don't want you to know. Cryptocurrency, conspiracy, corruption, crime, and cotton, but not spelled the way you would think. That's what today's episode is about. It comes to us courtesy of a fellow conspiracy realist, Chris, who wrote to us, Chris, if you recall, in a earlier listener mail segment, and Chris had asked us more about the strange story of the officially late crypto multimillionaire Gerald William Cotton, or Jerry with a G to his friends. What follows is a series of strange, interconnected conspiracies hindering on scams, greed, and grifts, but just possibly hindering on the concept of pseudocide. We've got a lot of stuff to unravel here. We may not get to it all, but we are excited to dive in with you. So here are the facts. He was a young dude. At the height of his achievements, he was born May 11th, 1988 in Canada.
Yeah, I mean, it seems pretty typical for, you know, burgeoning kind of boy geniuses in this crypto space. You know, it's sort of like almost become like a meme or a bit of a parody. But yeah, he was born Gerald William Cotton on May 11th of 1988 in Canada. His official death date was December 9th, 2018. Meaning that he would have been 30 years old, if the story is to be believed.
And Cotton lived in old Belleville, Ontario, before he headed on down to business school at York University in Toronto. And he graduated there in 2010. He had a bachelor's degree in business administration. So, you know, he's on his way up to have a legit job making tons and tons of money.
I think he already had a job, but we'll get to it.
Yeah, he definitely did. He had a side hustle.
He sure did. Yeah, or maybe college was the side hustle. Unclear, but I have opinions. There is an interesting gap in Cotton's timeline from 2010 to 2013. Here's what we know. He was very busy, as you and I just alluded, Matt, both during his higher education, probably before, and by the end of 2013, he had relocated to Vancouver, and he had started what would become, for a very brief time, a massively successful company. If you're not one of the people who reads about cryptocurrency and Bitcoin and so on, you might not have heard of Cotton before. Netflix documentary drops next year. But if you are familiar with the world of cryptocurrency, you know a little bit about his professional past, which is edging into legend at this point. Anyhow, 2013, he founds this outfit called Quadriga FinTech Solutions with a business partner. Yeah, not the most smooth name, but his business partner is going by the name Michael Patron. We'll explain what we mean by that a little later.
I gotta ask, I mean, is this the kind of thing you name your company to make it sound like a big, massive, you know, biotech firm when it's all kind of really just smoke and mirrors? Or is there something behind these kind of imaginary sounding words like Quadriga and FinTech? Mm-hmm. I guess FinTech is finance tech.
Quadriga is, I think it is a kind of, so I was looking this up and I was trying to figure out if I could find some clear evidence of why they named it this way. But a quadriga is a real thing. It's a chariot that's drawn by four horses. It was used, and they're all in one straight line. It was used for chariot racing in the Roman Empire.
Like some Ben-Hur type stuff. Yeah.
According to a Vanity Fair article, that quadriga, the four-person chariot, was used because there were four people who basically controlled the funds that flowed into and out of this exchange, which we're going to tell you about.
Which will figure into the story a bit later. The specificity. Right, the specificity of who had control of these.
And can't recommend enough that article matches cited Ponzi schemes, private yachts. Won't give you the whole title, but it's The Strange Tale of Quadriga by a journalist named Nathaniel Rich. I was not able to independently discover exactly why they these two guys that we know of named it that, but a quadriga is a real thing. And then also Rich seems pretty convinced that it was named for the idea of these four individuals powering it. So it's weird because quadriga itself is not so much the subject of the action here. It's the operator of what's called a cryptocurrency exchange. This one's called Quadriga CX, which over the course of a few years, just a few, would go on to become the largest cryptocurrency exchange in the entirety of Canada. This is where we see, I think, one of the first plot wrinkles. And I know everybody clocked it here, too. You can't start one of these without something to financially prime the pump. So the big question is, where did Patrin and Cotton get their seed money to begin with? How did they start the exchange? That's a question we can speculate at. We can speculate at later, but for now, just keep that in the front of your mind. Somehow, these two guys who have interesting past that the customers of Quadriga are not aware of, somehow they managed to start this thing that automatically blows up. And why does it blow up? A lot of it goes down to timing and culture. I think we can say that with certainty.
Yeah, and essentially, I mean, a crypto exchange is literally what it sounds like. It's like, you know, where you can convert one type, you know, first of all, you can buy cryptocurrency using American dollars or euros or in this case, Canadian currency. And then once you've done that, let's say you take your initial, fiat currency and invest it in Bitcoin or whatever, you can then exchange that currency into any number of hundreds of other currencies. And usually it lends these coins more legitimacy when they end up on a prominent exchange. So like some of these fly-by-night cryptocurrencies, they won't be on the big exchanges. And if they do, it makes big news. And oftentimes that in and of itself can move the price. You know, the Shiba Inu coin is now all of a sudden on crypto.com. And that can really balloon the price of a coin like that.
We're probably going to get into this later, Ben, I'm assuming. But this exchange, Quadriga Exchange, actually used tokens as a system of exchange. So you would go into their system and buy tokens, which you could then use to exchange for crypto. And I'm assuming vice versa. And we're about to get into that later.
At this point, 2013, 2014, cryptocurrency is becoming something that the mainstream knows about. Even if they're not dabbling with it themselves, that's due in part to the coverage of the Silk Road, which we did some episodes on in the past. By February of 2014, just 1 month after Quadriga launches their online platform, this thing called Mt. Gox, which had been the largest crypto exchange in Canada up to that point, was going down in flames. They had lost around 850,000 of their customers' bitcoins. So Quadriga all of a sudden becomes like, imagine a news story breaks and Pepsi is poisoned. Coke sales skyrocket. That's a rough analogy for what's happening here. Quadriga was inarguably in the right place at the right time, and it did not take long for the company to end up capturing about 80% of Canada's entire crypto exchange market. In simple terms, that's a ton of money.
Oh, it's insane. But just back to Mt. Gox briefly, like it was hacked. All of that money was stolen, like 850,000 bitcoins, which the value of today, I can't even do the math, but I mean, it's, you know, millions and millions and millions of dollars. So there was also like a moment of like swooping in and being like, okay, we're going to bring your faith back. You know, we're going to like have some kind of backing to this system that will make sure something like Mt. Gox can't ever happen again to us.
Yeah. The other wrinkle here is that at least, again, I keep citing that Vanity Fair article is so extensive. One of the big problems was exchanging this stuff had to occur in Japan, like physically in Japan, if you were going to do certain types of exchanges. So Quadriga would allow those exchanges to occur in Canada, which was a major plus for the company.
Right. Yeah. Because Mt. Gox, before its fall, because it was a Tokyo-based exchange, I think it was 70% of the entire global Bitcoin trade was going through Mt. Gox. So back to Quadriga. The world is full of business success stories just like this. You know what I mean? And it can be inspiring to people. Here's a couple of guys who ostensibly didn't start with silver spoons in their mouths, and now they are some of the biggest players and one of the newest, most disruptive of tech industries. But people started to take a closer look. They dipped their fingers beneath the PR surface and they found indications of problems on the horizon. Quadriga did end up having employees, one of whom was a hapless regulatory attorney. If you're listening, shout out to you. The biggest problem that people noticed immediately was that Cotton seemed to be functioning as sort of a one-man army. This one guy was running the entirety of this gigantic exchange, this Leviathan of an entity. And also the company didn't have a lot of things that these companies would be expected to have, like standard accounting software or a way to not only track funds, you know, in a transparent manner, but it didn't have metrics against which to measure its own success. And I love the point you brought up, Matt, about the about Mt. Gox and Tokyo. If you wanted to cash out from Quadriga, you had to physically meet in a location and take the funds in physical cash. So like not getting that stuff wired to you.
Yeah.
Like a parking lot?
Yeah, totally like, normal.
What are we talking
totally
here?
Normal. Right. Wells Fargo does but the same.
But people still
liked
it. Who doesn't like the idea of being able to make a ton of money with a new investment, right?
But if they've got 80% of Canada's crypto business and there's only three people working for the company, who's meeting them in the parking lot? Is it just literally one of the three guys or four guys, rather?
Maybe it was like a Task Rabbit situation, if you guys remember.
Man, maybe.
Task
That's
Rabbit.
Wild. So, that's super sketchy.
But remember, we're talking 2013, 2014, right? That's when we're really talking about right
that's
here.
That's right. So not massive scale. Not so 80% isn't like a massive number. Even if it's 80%, like the number of people that are into crypto at this point is probably maybe in the hundreds.
And just remember, around that time, we mentioned the Silk Road, Bitcoin was being used for things that sometimes was being used for things that you may want to operate more on a cash system going in and out of it, right? Rather than having a bunch of things traced going into a bank account, something like that.
Right. Beanie Babies, Pogs.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, vintage Snapple, the kind of stuff you don't want your friends knowing you're into.
Yeah.
But you're right. You know, trafficking and drugs being a huge part of that. That's what they were associated with in the earlier days. This is something we have to say this at first. In Quadriga's defense and in defense of other companies in what corporate America would call this space at this time, their hands were tied in the world of banking because they could not conform to regulations. Even like a lot of banking regulations end up being toothless at the top. You know what I mean? If you're reaching a certain level of financial success, if the punishment for a crime is a fee, then that is not a crime for the people who can afford the fee. It's a cost of doing business. And it's something that's unfortunately true in many cases. I want to go back to what you said, Matt, earlier. So Quadriga couldn't use these traditional banking channels. They didn't have any business accounts because no regulated bank, no normal bank would touch them. And this was, again, a problem for similar outfits. So Quadriga used other methods. They used what was called a platform credit system. So like let's say, Noel, let's use you as an example. You've got $10 and you put $10 US or Canadian into this exchange. Let's just say US for the sake of the example. When you put in that 10 bucks, you get what's called 10 quadriga bucks, and you can trade the quadriga bucks on the exchange. It's almost like Dave and Buster's money. Why do they have these shenanigans? Well, the problem is this. If people are putting money into the platform and they're buying Bitcoin straight from there, that would mean that, legally speaking, Quadriga is a money transmitting entity. This alternative arrangement is just them selling tokens, kind of like the way that if you go to an art party or you go somewhere without a liquor license, you can donate money and they'll give you a, you know, an award-winning beer like a PBR.
This feels like a very similar thing to games that many of us probably play on our phones, where you may buy from the game platform tokens that can be exchanged for other things. In a weird way, you're never exchanging money for an actual thing other than their tokens. I don't know.
Yeah, not directly, right? Yeah, it seems like a small, weaselly loophole, but it is an important one. It gets stranger than that, too. When customers wired money in, the funds did not go straight to Quadriga. They went through a series of shell companies. These companies were meant to kind of obscure things if they needed to be obscured, and most importantly, to avoid scrutiny of regulatory bodies. The street name for this is, by the way, money laundering. That's what it is. They used a lot of processors. They also worked with a big fish called Crypto Capital, which will come into play later. But so far, 2014, things are pretty exciting. Things are on the up and up. In 2015, the company starts saying, well, let's go public. And at this point, still, the company is not quite, you know, how Trent Reznor is basically 9-inch nails. Cotton is pretty much in the back end. He's pretty much Quadriga, but he still has support staff. He still is working with Patron and making a move to go public. To your earlier point, Noel, about legitimacy in general, this could be huge for the company because it's a stamp of approval from the world of investors.
But there was another wrinkle. By the end of 2014, they were not doing particularly well. They were operating at a loss, a hefty loss, $90,000 Canadian net loss. And it's a little tough to kind of take a step back and see the whole view here because Quadriga's accounting was really, really bad. But Patron did seem to think that there was a cash flow problem, and he put $150K of his own money in, along with $700K that they raised from some other investors. And in March of that year, after another round of publicly announced fundraising, Quadriga said that it was ready to go public. But that never happened.
Yes, and this is a weird story, and it only gets weirder from here. We're going to take a quick break and hear a word from our sponsors, and we'll be right back.
We've returned. End of 2014, the company has like a functional revenue of a little north of $20,000. So it's not looking particularly rosy. The issue here is that the real picture of their net loss versus gains or what have you is really tough to see because that accounting was not up to snuff. So it's December, it's 2015, two rounds of fundraising, pretty lucrative rounds. The company has burned through all of that new investment and Cotton pretty much fires everyone, including, interestingly enough, their regulatory attorney. Fast forward 2016. Michael Patron is also out. He cuts ties with both Quadriga as a company and with Gerald Cotton. Cotton is now fully Trent Reznor, 9-inch nail style on his own. But loneliness could be a damaging thing for some human psyches. Cotton created a dummy account on the exchange. He made a friend. This friend's name, Chris Markey. And Cotton, again, had control over the entirety of the back end. So what Cotton did is he credited his new newly minted friend, Chris Markey, with a ton of fake money. And then through Chris Markey, Cotton bought real Bitcoin, and he repeated the process with Ethereum. Fast forward, 2017. Yeah, he's doing this for a while. He's moving wing. Cotton is essentially printing money at this point. He's assigning his pal Chris a fake value or a spoof value, and then using that to purchase real crypto. And he's doing this to an extreme, egregious degree. The Ontario Securities Commission will later find that 95% of trades on Quadriga are actually Chris Markey trades. He's trading against his own customers. He created a Ponzi scheme.
Wow. Is that like the robbing Peter to pay Paul kind of situation?
Yeah, very much so. A Ponzi scheme works as long as it has uninhibited growth. And what you do is you make these wild promises of profits far above the norm that an investor would expect. And every time somebody pays into this, you take the money that they have paid and you give it to the folks who've been in the game longer and are expecting returns. The problem is, if you're like Ponzi, the namesake of this scheme, then you're taking a taste at the very minimum out of everything people are doing. It could be as something as small as like a transaction fee, but in most cases it's not, because Ponzi schemes are grifts. They are scams. They're not sustainable.
And also what they need is presumably replenishing pool of funds and unbridled access to it, and nobody thinking to check on it. You know what I mean? Like, either you're like a money manager or something, there would be no indication, there would be no red flags for someone to be like, oh, my money's gone, because as far as they're concerned, the money's still there. It's just being moved around. There's nothing earmarking who that money belongs to. It's just part of the big pool, right?
Yeah. The house of cards is falling around 2018. It's reaching the end of the typical Ponzi scheme pattern, which means new deposits are directly being used to fund withdrawals from more and more people saying, hey, where's my money? What's the delay? And you can see the forums where people are saying, well, the delay is really on the Canadian banks. They're the bad guys. We're trying to get this to you. And then Cotton is, if you didn't know about his past, you would say Cotton has an extreme intuitive ability to sense what's down the road here, because he actually transfers some of the money he stole back into the exchange as a stopgap, as a Band-Aid. And October 2018, he marries his longtime girlfriend, Jennifer Robertson. Cue the music. Wonderful things. Just a month later, and this is something, Matt, you mentioned on that listener mail segment, he makes a will. And in his will, he leaves all of his assets. Well, he leaves some to his dogs, Chihuahuas. And he leaves all his assets.
Seriously?
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, about 100K.
Yeah, 80, 100K. And 3 days after signing this will, he and his new bride travel to India. It's the afternoon of December 8th, 2018. It's a little bit past 5 p.m. Cotton and Robertson land in Hapur, India, and they check in to a hotel named the Oberoi Raj Villas. Cotton, according to the story, takes ill. And a day later, he officially dies of complications from Crohn's disease. His cause of death is listed as cardiac arrest, and depending on which death certificate you read, he either died at that hotel or he died at a private hospital called Fortis Escorts. Or did he die at all? Here's where it gets crazy. So notice, folks, we've used the word allegedly and officially when describing Cotton's death. In that earlier listener mail segment, we also hinted at this controversy through using these same terms. And the truth of the matter is that many, many people, not just burned customers or victims of this outfit. They believe that Cotton may have faked his death. Why? Why would you do that? How would you do it?
Well, I mean, we've kind of already set this up and established the fact that Cotton was in trouble. He knew that not only local authorities, but the feds were circling him. They were sniffing around. They knew something was up, and he's got all this money. So, like, you can only imagine that, like, if he wasn't already on the run by going to India and having this marriage and honeymoon, right? He was going to be on the run very soon after that. Or you can imagine him being prepared for that and or preparing for it. But then there's just the cause of his death in general, how it occurred and how rapidly it came about.
Right. Yeah. Crohn's disease, for anybody unfamiliar, we mentioned this previously. Crohn's disease is a kind of IBD, inflammatory bowel disease, and it can be a real pain on multiple levels, because it can give you diarrhea, weight loss, fatigue, abdominal issues. It can lead to malnutrition. But dying of Crohn's disease would be an exceedingly rare event.
Yeah, a good friend of mine that I grew up with, lots of sleepovers and stuff like that. Their mother had Crohn's disease, and it was very manageable. It was painful when there were flare-ups, but it was the kind of thing you take medication for your whole life, and it would allow you to live a pretty normal, you know, day-to-day life. It wasn't something that I witnessed, you know, and I was over there a lot. I never witnessed, like, some kind of crazy situation where there was an episode of some kind. It was just something that, you know, maybe she was tired that day or something, but that was usually the bulk of it. But I've certainly never really heard of it killing anybody. Not to say that it doesn't happen, but
it is possible maybe that he had a pre-existing heart condition of which he was unaware, and that the flare-up of Crohn's somehow in a dark, unenviable lottery led to his unexpected death. It's possible, again, but as far as someone dying just from straight up Crohn's disease, the best we can say is that it is very, very rare. So, as we were saying, many, many people don't think he actually died. Why? He had a motive, like you said, Matt. He also had some really sketchy stuff about his, again, official demise. Local governments, not just in India, but in different parts of the world, can and have been bribed for what some people might find to be a surprisingly reasonable fee. The story of Cotton's body gets pretty murky, to be honest with you. From what we found, there was a doctor at the Mahatma Gandhi Hospital who refused to sign an embalming certificate on December 10th. And Cotton's body was taken to the SMS Medical College, where the supervisor there never actually saw the body. The embalming certificate was signed and processed by a junior staffer. So you would say, okay, fine, guys, I get it. An embalming certificate, that sounds official and legit. But usually when people die, there's a death certificate. So what happened to that? Isn't that the first thing investigators would look at? Yeah, and they found two. So they had doubled up on the death certificates. There are at least two out there. One listed his place of death as Fortis Hospital, but another one listed as that hotel, Raj Villas. Also, the name on the death certificate for the hotel, which was obtained by an outfit called CoinDesk, the name is misspelled. Could be a clerical error. You know what I mean?
It's definitely possible.
Or what? Just like, what's the alternative? Just sloppy?
Yeah, I think either like sloppy and clerical error would be, I think, pretty much the same. My question is, you know, if you're looking for discrepancies, that's a discrepancy that pops out. You know, that's one to highlight. But what would be the advantage? Would he, you know, would the plan be, if one was faking one's death, to come back a decade or so later and say, actually, that was a different Michael Cotton who died. Nice try, coppers.
So wait, so it's, you know, the official spelling of his name is C-O-T-T-E-N. Was the misspelling changing it to an O?
I believe it was a K.
Oh, Cotton with a K. So maybe that was just the really extreme version of him, you know? Spells it with a K, you know, like X's are in there somewhere.
Actually, it was Gerald Catan, brother of former SNL actor Chris Catan.
I guess all I'm saying is that would be a pretty obvious ruse if you were going to do it trying to be, you know, covert about it. You'd think you'd change the E to an O.
Well, I mean, you never know who filled it out. Well, how much was, you know, his wife involved in all of this? There's some weirdness when you look at her, too, and her activities, because he passes away officially on the 8th. Then 2 days later, she departs, right? She takes off out of India, and she lets the orphanage know that they were going to do the charity work with and have that ceremony for. She lets them know through an email that she's not going to be there, because she's got to go back to Canada with her husband's, unfortunately, deceased body.
But I mean, the biggest red flag of all here is the will, you know, making it that close to the supposed demise of this individual. I mean, not to say that, you know, forward-thinking young people don't make wills in their 30s, but it's certainly not something that's top of mind, you know, especially when you're living large. You know, like that. I mean, maybe it's the opposite. Maybe it's exactly that reason. Oh, I'm living large. If something were to happen to me, I would hate for my, you know, funds to disappear, especially with crypto where there's no real law governing it, or like how it's not the same laws, I believe, governing like, you know, a bank account or property or something like that. So, but still super weird that it was just days, mere days. And everything just seems too explainable, you know. Oh, it's rare to die from Crohn's disease, but it, the comorbidity, it certainly can happen. It's a little unusual, but seems legit.
Yeah, I mean, everybody so far has died at some point. Life is kind of a one-way ride, unless you're Henrietta Lacks, and I don't think a lot of people would envy that position. But yeah, it's a good point. Like, did he get a vibe? Did he have some intuition that says, hey, I need to button things up just in case, maybe a twinge of heart pain or something like that? Or was this part of a plan? Yeah, that's the thing. We don't want to unfairly disparage his widow, especially imagine the idea of losing the person you just married on your honeymoon. That is almost impossible for a lot of people to imagine, or I hope it's almost impossible for a lot of people to imagine. And despite this grief, this enormous grief beyond words, like you said, Matt, she's able to leave the country. She's not only able to leave the country, but she's able to return to Canada with her husband's body in a very short amount of time. How do we know this? We know because on December 14th, Cotton's remains were buried in a closed casket service in Canada. Fast forward a month later, Jennifer Robertson announces her husband's death to the world on January 14th, meaning there was another gap in time. There was a month before the customers of Quadriga or the people following it had any real idea of what was going on, other than, you know, they were getting a lot of delays if they tried to withdraw their funds. And around this time, people were no longer able to take their money out of the exchange. It was no longer a two-way street. The company, in fact, ceased operations, but people were still able to put money in. And that money, because, you know, we explained the stage the Ponzi scheme is at now, that money was used to support the spoofed numbers that Quadriga was so deep into at this point. And then if you fast forward to January 31st, the company finally announces bankruptcy. Gerald William Cotton, Jerry to his friends, had died. Most of the world agreed. And when he died, he apparently took his passwords to his grave.
Jeez Louise. That is one thing they say in the crypto, you know, sphere or whatever. They say, not your code, not your coins, something along the lines of that. So there will be these key. I'm sorry, not your keys, not your coins. So in other words, if you've lost some unique identifying password or some random number generator thing that like exchange like this or like a, you know, a wallet or a bank generates, those are dead to you. Those coins, they just exist in the ether. It's impossible to get to because the whole point of the blockchain is all about encryption. You know, it's all about protecting it from, you know, theft. But that's why it was so sketchy from the first place, that the whole deal with this company was only these four guys. They had too much access. And apparently it wasn't the four. It was really just Jerry.
Right. And this is, we know a lot of this because of some excellent investigative work. We also know about it because of some work by regulatory bodies who went in and really did some forensic accounting in a way that gets pretty disturbing. We'll pause for a word from our sponsors, and when we return, we'll talk a little bit more about the aftermath of Cotton's, again, official demise. Show me the money, Jerry. Oh my God, I was waiting for that one. Is that a movie reference? That is, right?
Well, Jerry Maguire. Okay. Yeah, Jerry Maguire. He says, "Show me the money." Cuba Gooding Jr. says that to him. And then also, "You complete me." Oh, okay. Wait, no, you had me a hello. You had me a hello.
You had me.
Sorry.
You had me a Bitcoin.
You had me a hello.
Oh, you had me a crypto. That's one of the questions. When did this money go missing? Quadriga had these things called cold wallets, and it turned out that months before Cotton's official death, several of these wallets had been emptied. They had been emptied, in fact, right around the time one of their main processors, Crypto Capital, had also crashed and burned. Their accounts were seized by government agents.
Can we talk about a cold wallet really fast?
Yeah, break down a cold wallet.
It's like cold storage, right?
It is kind of like cold storage. It's a hard drive that's not connected in any way to the network, the internet. It's just your stuff lives on that hard drive. It's over there. Nobody's touching it. It's secured while it's physically secured.
It's the kind of thing that if you were going to protect your own stash and you didn't have it on an exchange, because again, you're really, they say don't keep your stuff on an exchange. You could literally put them on a hard drive yourself and put that in a safe deposit box.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, but buyer beware, because you might find yourself in the unfortunate position of that guy who lost his hard drive, his cold wallet in a junkyard. And currently, I think still, I haven't checked on him in a while, I think still had like an open reward for someone to help him find it. It's an unenviable position. But yes, several of those appear to have been emptied before Cotton's demise. And later estimates from regulatory bodies concluded that all told, there was 25,600 missing Bitcoins, 11,000 Bitcoin Cash, 11,000 Bitcoin Cash SV, 430,000 Ethereum, and 35,000 Bitcoin Gold. This may be gobbledygook to a lot of people outside of the world of cryptocurrency, but maybe the best way to explain it is that as of around March, February of 2021, that adds up to something like $1.85 billion.
And this is in 2015 valuation. So, I mean, you know, a Bitcoin today, I think, is worth what, like $65,000?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, as of around February, March of this year, that total would add up to like $1.5 billion.
Would add up to that today. Got it. Perfect.
And now, with great interest and delight, I propose that we turn to the story of Michael Patron. Because as you may have noticed, fellow conspiracy realists, we were taking pains to say he was going by that name at the time, or he calls himself that now. His original name is not Michael Patron, it is Omar Danani.
Yeah, Michael Patron already kind of sounds like a made-up name, doesn't it? He changed his name at least twice that we know of. He was, in fact, a convicted felon who worked with an identity theft ring known as the Shadow Crew. And Patron and Cotton almost certainly knew each other well before their venture with Quadriga. And to me, this already implies that Cotton likely knew about this the Shadow Crew. He seems like the type. Again, remember all those gaps we were talking about, right? Is that your theory, Ben? I don't want to scoop you on that. You talked about a theory about how they were putting together the scratch for this, you know, supposedly more above board venture with Quadriga. You think it was from stealing identities and just like doing something?
Dude, we're going to talk about this, and Ben's going to hit you with, it's crazy. They were doing so much stuff when they were younger people.
Yeah, well, there's all that time gap. Well, I'm sorry. I'm just, my mind is spinning.
Right. Yeah, keep it spinning, man.
Let's keep it spinning.
We're gonna spin our own heads here, Exorcist style, and we're gonna do it with the help of two people, a Reddit user named QCXINT, and some excellent research by Amy Castor, like castor oil. They found strong indications, just of what you're saying, that Cotton and Patron were active in Ponzi schemes earlier, different older iterations, kind of harbingers of what would become Quadriga. Castor, in fact, traces Cotton's criminal career all the way back to the tender age of 15, when a lot of people in the U.S. were like stressed about getting their learner's license. This guy was learning how to puppeteer financial things on a macro scale.
That's insane. Can I ask a quick question? Yeah. What the thing that makes a Ponzi scheme illegal is the fact that you are toying with other people's funds in ventures that they are not aware of, that are very risky, in the hopes of reaping high yield rewards? Or am I missing something? Because I mean, that's what a money manager does, but usually you have an understanding of the types of risk, or the levels of risk that your money manager is going to take with your money, and you sort of determine that. Is this the fact that they don't know that the money's being moved around? I mean, presumably they want their money to grow. I mean, can you maybe just explain that, Ben or Matt? What part of it makes it illegal? Because on its surface, it's got this shell of legitimacy, a Ponzi scheme.
I mean, I can tell you a little bit. Just my understanding of these HYIP, is that right? A high yield investment programs?
Yes.
Okay, so yeah, I mean, these babies are... They're ripe. If you're a smart person, you can set up some like legit sounding names. You can do some interesting stuff. And the work of Amy Castor there and that Reddit user, they really look into some of the stuff that Cotton was doing back when he was 15 years old. And you can also look at that Vanity Fair article we talked about there, where they discuss like some things that they did. Like Jerry set up stuff when he was a kid at his parents' computer that took people's money and then exited with those people's money and just shut the thing down. And he was communicating with this Michael Patron guy before he was Michael Patron. I don't know if it was before he was Michael Patron or not. But they would communicate it on this place called Talk Gold, which was a place where they could exchange information and basically prop each other up and support each other.
Yeah, exactly. Like if I could explain it in cinematic terms, here's why Ponzi schemes are illegal. Here's why pyramid schemes are illegal. First, they're unsustainable. But the truth of the matter is that they ultimately cannot expand beyond the size of the population of planet Earth. And to be successful forever without falling apart, they have to eventually expand past that threshold. Now, with the emergence of AI, could there be an unending Ponzi scheme? Maybe. It depends on how quickly you can mint new sentience, right? But right now with meat bags, yeah, that's why. It breaks down because of the math and the idea of that growth.
But yeah, so the growth is it's a red flag if you're entering into a situation where 100% growth is promised. You know, that should be a red flag. Like, this is probably not something that's real. But the interesting thing is, like, nowadays there are these crypto projects, you know, where you get these tokens or these like coin pairs where you can get like you mint a new token by pairing a coin like a Binance coin or a Bitcoin with a token of these projects, and they do promise 100% yield. And if you watch them over time, it's called yield farming. It's this whole thing. And it is rife for exploitation. And we had a story the other day about this rug pull situation where with the Uber or crypto eats. So this is way pre that, but those things do exist today, still very much in the crypto space. They're just not necessarily on the more legitimate exchanges. This would have been a Wild West period of exchanges too, you know, as evidenced by the whole meet me in the parking lot to get your money. It's fascinating stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, I guess if you want to be less cinematic and more technical, the reason a Ponzi scheme is illegal is because the money that's paid to the Ponzi investors is described as income, but it's not income. It's a distribution of capital. So they're just moving the money around, pretending that that money is coming from some sort of profit, which it is not.
And that's my last question is that there. So they're inherent in this model. There is no profit. I mean, I assume the value of the coins being invested grow along with the market, but this fund or whatever isn't actually doing anything at all. To other than moving the funds around to pay this fake dividend to the older investors using the newer investors' money, and then eventually it just catches up, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's tremendously profitable for the person running the grift or the people, but maybe not so much for the customers. So we know a little bit about how Patron made a name for himself. Because these guys, in terms of criminal activity, they were peanut butter and jelly. Two great tastes that taste great together. Patron started out, as far as people can tell, by helping others launder money through a mixing program. You would mix it in a token scheme called eGold. And then later you would be able to get your money out for a reasonable fee and your money would be clean. Dahani ultimately gets deported as a result of his conviction for identity fraud / theft with the Shadow Crew. And then he and Cotton appear to have teamed up for another operation using the Midas Gold Exchange, or sometimes called M Gold Exchange, in 2008. And they were a big piece of what they were doing here was a pre-Bitcoin digital currency called Liberty Reserve. You can imagine it came with some political leanings. It was it was like, imagine, so just like our earlier example, right, Noel, where we had you buy one quadriga buck or 10 quadriga bucks, $1 is equal to one Liberty Reserve token, basically. And you can send that token to anyone else anywhere on the network with, you know, a little VIG. A small taste going to Liberty Reserve itself as a transaction fee. Imagine a PayPal that doesn't need you to verify your identity. Huh? You can already see the potential, right, folks? You can already hear the illegal money just pouring in. All you need is an email address, and there are plenty of ways to get around email address stuff, or at least there were at this time. It's probably a little tougher now. This company, Liberty Reserve, it grew to more than a million users before it was shut down in 2013, and regulators at the time called it the largest money laundering scheme in U.S. history. They were actually able to do this because of the Patriot Act, which gave them powers they wouldn't ordinarily have to connect this with possible terrorism or drug running through the trade of U.S. currency abroad.
But it was found to basically be funding that, right? Those exchanges were funding trafficking of drugs and other things and terrorism, at least in the overall Liberty Reserve and Midas Gold Exchange.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, they weren't framed. Make no mistake.
No.
It wasn't a stitch up job, but it goes deeper than that, because at the same time, the same year Liberty Reserve is shut down, Cotton and Patron founded Quadriga. And it goes deeper than that. Like Dead Press says, it's deeper than rap. It appears that Cotton and Patron had been, as you said, Matt, interacting on several other schemes through other forums, things like Black Hat World and, as you mentioned, Talk Gold. And later investigations linked several handles to both men. In Cotton's case, one was Scepter and the other was Murdoch Leet, or, you know, for people who don't use Leet speak, Murdoch 1337. Interestingly enough, Murdoch 1337 was active in August of 2019, months after Cotton officially died.
So you think that's him?
Yeah, so people who believe that he successfully faked his death will point to that as evidence of his activity. But again, with the anonymity of the internet for most people, is it possible that somebody else was just, you know, just had his login?
Oh, so that's definitely associated with him, like in for real. Okay, got it.
Oh yes, for real. Yeah, it's associated with him. If you want to learn more about that, again, go to search for Amy Castor's work on it, which does a great and thorough job of linking these together. And also, honorable mention to Crypto Capital. We mentioned them as one of the big processors. Their president was a guy named Ivan Manuel Molina Lee. I don't know if you have heard of him in the news, folks, but he was most recently in the news because he was arrested in Poland in 2019 in connection with money laundering, being part of an international drug cartel. And if you look at the charges against him, he apparently is also charged in a cover-up to hide the loss of $850 million in client and corporate funds. So this example, I think, is important because we don't know, we being the public, don't know how deep these things go. We don't know how much money is actually being moved around, and we don't know how these folks are or are not related to each other in the world of crypto.
Yeah, it's fascinating too. I think I said this when we did the story in Strange News or Listener Mail, rather. I don't know that we've still yet have like a public sense of who the big crypto mafiosos are. You know, who the big players in the crime world associated with crypto are. Because even this, you know, Jerry Cotton fellow, very much not a household name. We all admitted that and didn't know about it until we heard about this Netflix documentary that was coming up. And this guy, Ivan Manuel Molina Lee, I mean, he's accused of laundering tons and tons of money for international drug cartels using this crypto format called Bitfinex, which is run by the same company who created something called Tether, which is a one-to-one USD kind of substitute. You know, it's pegged to the US dollar. So it's a way that I believe crypto people can, like, you know, pay for things using Tether because it's like not the same value as a dollar, one-to-one. Again, I'm not an expert of it. I'm just kind of, you know enough to be dangerous, but Tether is very popular and it's something that's very, like, you know, household and at least in the crypto community. So for that company to be associated with this guy, I mean, what else is there, you know?
Right. Who is Satoshi Nakamoto?
Right.
No one officially knows. But there are a couple of leads of varying credibility, right, or varying plausibility. Yeah, I think this is an excellent example. The world is not entirely aware of how deep the rabbit hole goes here. This is a renaissance of money laundering, at the very least. You know what I mean? These are the glory days. That's what future financial criminals may well call them. So where are we at currently? As we said, it goes without saying that not everyone believes Gerald William Cotton has actually left the building. As a matter of fact, lawyers had been pushing to have his official grave exhumed. This is a request that Canadian authorities have so far denied. The Netflix documentary we mentioned at the top, Trust No One, The Hunt for the Crypto King, premieres in 2022, and it plans to investigate the case following the bilked investors who are searching for, and I think, U.S. equivalent $217 million that Cotton himself is believed to have absconded with. But not everybody agrees. You'll find a lot of people who believe, yes, Cotton was a thief. Maybe he was even addicted to the thrill of scamming. But they don't buy into the theories that he could have faked his death. Instead, they're saying, yeah, he was a thief, but he also genuinely passed away unexpectedly on his honeymoon in India. And the thing you can say in the favor of folks holding that view is that it is incredibly difficult to commit pseudocide in a sustainable way. For further reading, check out Elizabeth Greenwood's awesome book, Playing Dead. And there are also two great podcasts we wanted to recommend that are deep dives into this story. One of the first is Exit Scam. And Matt, what's the name of that second one that we were tuning into?
It's a CBC podcast. It's called A Death in Crypto Land.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're good listens. Check them out. I mean, to be fully transparent, you know, they're not. This is not us plugging a podcast for anything other than the substance of it. Especially if you're interested in this story, as far as the officials are concerned, the case of the death is pretty much closed. But again, a lot of people who lost a lot of money are convinced there's more to this story. At this point, I have to ask you guys before we wrap. Matt, Noel, fellow conspiracy realists tuning in, what do you think? Is Cotton alive? Is Cotton passed beyond this mortal veil?
I think he did it. I think he's one of the few success stories of being able to properly do this. Because again, part of the crypto thing is like it being untraceable. Or not untraceable, but like, you know, if you know the right people, you can spend that money without tipping off the IRS and live off the grid. A different grid, but off the main grid.
If he is truly the genius guy that many believe he is, he did some things that would lead me to believe he faked his death. He got that Cessna. He was getting his pilot's license. He was training to fly. He got a boat, a yacht that he could, you know, learned how to pilot that thing or to drive that thing. What is it? You drive a boat?
He also yacht is also highly customized in a way that could allow someone, if they are lucky, avoiding detection, it could allow someone to travel internationally without all those pesky border regulations.
Yeah, but his wife tried to sell it immediately after he died, right? What I'm thinking is he learned the skills to be able to fly and to, you know, drive a boat. Like, he knows how to do this now, and if he's got enough of this money in cash form, then he's traveling around the world, he can make use of it and travel between countries, perhaps, in a more quiet manner. He also allegedly was traveling around the world, perhaps allegedly leaving money in various accounts. Again, if you believe that that's part of the mastermind story, like you believe him to be a mastermind criminal. I don't know. I'm certainly intrigued by the whole thing. And if you're as intrigued as I am, like we said, there's stuff for you to check out to continue down the rabbit hole. And if you want to reach out to us and tell us what you think, you can find us all over the internet.
Boy, can you ever. We don't make it hard at all to find us. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. You can find us on YouTube at the handle Conspiracy Stuff. We're also at Conspiracy Stuff Show on Instagram. And if you don't want to get on the internet at all, why not pick up a telephone? Give us a call using your hands and mouths.
Yes, our number is 1-833-STDWYTK. When you call in, give yourself a cool nickname. You've got 3 minutes. Say whatever you'd like. If you've got more that you'd like to send to us that can't fit into those 3 minutes, we highly recommend you instead send us a good old-fashioned email. We are
conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.